Hello, welcome back to the David Watson podcast. Today I spoke with Brian Townsend, who over 28 years span, many of those years within the DEA in America, he dealt a lot with drugs, criminals, cartels. And we had an incredible, insightful conversation today. Started off initially about fentanyl, but then it grew into the bigger problem, which is people's understanding, including my own, because my attitude towards drugs, the legalization of drugs, was liberal and is. It is very liberal. But in many ways, it's also wrong. And Brian is going to help me understand why. I hope you enjoy this episode. Hello. Welcome to the David Watson podcast. Thank you very much for joining me. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. Appreciate being here.
It's great to have you. And one of the things I guess we're going to get into is the topic of conversation of fentanyl. And one of the things I made sure I haven't done since you and I have arranged this is look up anything to do with fentanyl. Because the reason for that is I didn't want to get mixed up with internet opinion.
Ooh.
Okay, yeah. Versus the reality of somebody that dealt with it on the ground. And consequently has gone on to found a program to help people. Which is so amazing because, you know what I mean? It's as somebody that's been sort of had some dealings with drug addicts and stuff like that, as well as, you know, back in the day sort of thing, enjoying myself recreationally and stuff, there's differences. And it's not, nothing is black and white. And lots of these problems can be really nuanced, but it's in the nuances that we can find huge difficulties and tragic circumstances. So with that being said, tell me all about it.
Oh, well, it's such a interesting topic. I don't know where you want to start. Maybe the history a little bit.
Because you were 28 years in the DEA, isn't it? And is that the Drug Enforcement Agency?
It is, yeah. I actually spent 5 years as a police officer in the state of Missouri in the southwest corner in a town called Joplin. And then I went to the Drug Enforcement Administration, the DEA, which is a federal law enforcement agency in the United States. It's under the Department of Justice. And our task our mission is to fight drug trafficking. And I did that for 23 years. So 28 years total in law enforcement, 23 as a federal agent, and retired in 2022, and started my own training and consulting business, and also just started a nonprofit organization called Only 2MG Incorporated. So Only 2MG is representative of how little fentanyl it takes to kill you. Only 2 milligrams, which is just a few granules of salt or sand.
Yeah. So, because I realized when I originally, when you and I originally connected to make the podcast happen, that actually I didn't strictly know what fentanyl was. Hence the reason I didn't want to look it up because, like I said, it's just like sometimes you think you're learning something. And you're like, you know, why don't you just go in blind and see what education you learn instead?
Yeah, absolutely. So fentanyl is a illicit fentanyl is a synthetic opioid.
Right.
So meaning synthetic meaning it's man-made. There is no plant. It's completely chemicals. So we have really three categories of opioids. We have our natural opioids, which is from the poppy plant, the opium plant, poppy opium. And then that's where opium comes from. And then we have our semi-synthetics, which is where there's some type of chemical synthesis. So that would be like morphine to heroin.
Yeah, methadone, things like
heroin's
that.
A semi-synthetic, yeah. And then we have our fully synthetic, which is completely chemicals. And that's what fentanyl is.
Did you say illicit? Illicit fentanyl.
Yeah, I mean, well, medical fentanyl is also synthetic as well.
Okay. So is there a difference between them? What would the difference be then?
Well, medical fentanyl is actually a good thing.
Yeah.
If you've ever been hospitalized, if you've ever been in surgery, you've probably had medical fentanyl or some type of analog. And that's not a bad thing at all. Illicit fentanyl is made in labs and places in like Mexico and drug cartel controlled and very deadly and no quality control, no even distribution. It's just it's completely different.
Can I just clarify a few things? Because the reason I say this is because there's things like if you look at things like sports and bodybuilding and stuff, you get like growth hormones that people use. You know, something often gets labeled as steroids, and there's insulin misuse. But they all have a medical background where actually when used for their medical purpose, they save lives or improve lives or cure illnesses. You know, so if you're diabetic, insulin is essential. If you're a bodybuilder using insulin, it can become dangerous. You know, if you're a bodybuilder obsessed with growth hormones, it can cause huge problems. But actually, there's reasons for using growth hormones. You know, there's a reason for using steroids from a medical point of view. Everything, people take a steroid, it can take a steroid type inhaler to help them breathe because they have asthma. And it's actually the same sort of compounds that are used in sports to cheat with sports. But it's the purpose of their use that takes it away from, actually, this can be quite dangerous. And then where it comes from and how you obtained it. And then, well, actually, this makes it not just the way you're using it makes it dangerous, but where you got it from has made it even more dangerous. So if fentanyl, say they decided to legalize fentanyl, right, so that somebody could have it, because I actually don't know what high you would get from fentanyl. We can get into that, but would it still fall into I'm trying to build a description for people to try and understand the differences in dangers and misuse, because some things can be safe because they've become misused, right? Whereas some things are just dangerous and then people misuse them. So if you go back to the original like 1800s opioid dens with heroin and stuff like that, and the original opiates and stuff, that there was actually lots of people that safely used them for centuries, but then they become more and more refined and more misused. And it went from like a recreational misuse of an opioid to just get high, just like somebody might go and have a few beers after work. What I was saying is I'm trying to, because I literally have no knowledge of fentanyl and what its medical purpose is and stuff like that, is the difference between like illicit being where it comes from.
Yeah, and that for sure. That's one thing. Medical fentanyl was actually invented in the late 50s, early 60s by a doctor, Dr. Paul Janssen, if that's not really important, I guess. But and where it got its legs, where it really ultimately got its FDA approval in the United States, was through open heart surgery. I mean, it replaced morphine in the operating room. You know, a very powerful opioid, you know, 100 times more powerful than morphine. It only takes a little bit of this drug in a medical setting to relieve pain. I mean, I'm talking like a drop of this stuff. And ultimately, it wasn't really until the late 1990s, the early 2000s, at least in the United States, where we started seeing more of this on the streets. Now, it was being used illegally earlier than that, but it really wasn't any widespread abuse. And it wasn't really until our opioid epidemic, where legal opioids had flooded the United States, beginning with OxyContin in 1996, where we started to see more illicit fentanyl, and where we started to see it was in our heroin supply. But it was used for different purposes. Like medical fentanyl was created, like I said, 1959, 1960, to replace morphine.
Yeah.
You know, for simplest way I can just to put that out there, but and to relieve pain. And to this day, I mean, I think the World Health Organization has a list or medical fentanyl in its most essential medicines. And it's a good thing. Like I said, if you've been in severe pain, you've been in injury, you've probably had it. But we didn't see the illicit fentanyl really hit the streets until we had a opioid epidemic in this country. And then that turned into a increase in heroin use. And then drug traffickers realized that the properties were similar. It's an opioid. You know, heroin's an opioid. And but it's a lot cheaper and it's a lot more addictive. So they started to put a little bit into our heroin supply, and then it just took over. And you know, why manufacture heroin when it's more expensive? You know, you have the poppy plant, you know, to for the opium, and then you have to, you know, go to morphine to heroin, and it's just there's a lot more logistics involved. And fentanyl gives you all that, gives you the same characteristics, the same it's an opioid. I can't say that any, you know.
But
So it just took off from there.
because it's a difficult one, isn't it? Because there's this thing, like once upon a time, and I still partly sit on this chair, but once upon a time, I was a real advocate for all drugs should be legalized, right? People should just have free choice, right? And my two reasons for that was, we're not going to win something. Well, there's three reasons. One, I just believe people should fundamentally have free choice if the only person they're harming is themselves. The other one was just that, and the sheer number or amounts of money that was spent trying to fight criminals when you could license every single product through a government agency, and instead of spending tax money, you could make tax money. The problem is, that probably would have worked better if we'd have started that in the 80s and the 90s, because now we have all of these like underground chemical factories that can make things really cheaply to such strong amounts that strengths have just got out of control. And people are just, you know what I mean? Like I remember weed in the 90s versus weed in 2024. That just
Totally
two,
different.
yeah, you know what I mean? And it's just like,
We tell people it's this is not the weed today is not the weed Bob Marley smoked. This is on
100%.
average about 9 times more powerful.
And if you go on some of the websites and stuff like that, where they have like weed growing competitions and stuff like that, and you see the amount of effort they go into making the strains stronger and stronger and stronger, whereas 30 years ago it was just a random guy growing seeds.
No, 100%. They say the one marijuana cigarette today would be the about nine in the 1990s. It's about a 1-to-9 ratio on smoking a joint. That's how much more powerful it is.
It
And
is.
like you said, there's competitions on how to make it even stronger and stronger. It's incredible.
And you've gone down this road now where once upon a time having an edible was literally a cookie or a chocolate brownie. Whereas now they're like, oh no, we're going to put 1,000 milligrams in a gummy bear. He was
And
like,
by the way, when kids see that and they think it's candy, and we're seeing an increase in hospital visits with in pediatric hospitals. It's incredible.
And this is this danger we've gone to where things have just become, I'll tell you what, I think we can make it 10 times stronger than it ever needed to be. And that's what our original conversation was about, the original opioids, like in the opium dens in like Victorian 1800s and stuff like that. You were literally smoking it at its most raw form, and you take synthetic fentanyl versus that, and they're not even on the same scales anymore. They're so far apart.
Oh, it was even, I mean, there's so many instances of that. I mean, look at the modern day syringe was invented 1850, 1853. Morphine was been around since about 1825. And when they invented the syringe, morphine was 3 times more powerful. I mean, so I mean, even that increase was, you know, so what we see, we saw an increase in abuse, you know, same scenario, you know, just we're figuring out ways to get these drugs into our body a lot quicker, and
That's actually a very interesting phrase, because there seems to be this obsession with getting drugs into our bodies now. Did you
well,
mean? Because,
especially in the country. We have such a warm.
It is, and it's there's this kind of mindset that's shifted, because once upon a time, it used to very much be a form of recreational relaxation. Did you mean? Whereas yeah. Now it's become a way to live.
Yeah, they're so highly addictive, and that's part of the problem that fentanyl has in it. Now we have a drug that's changing that recreational, that casual drug use, that drug experimentation, because people are now dying on first-time drug use. First time. That never happened before. We didn't have fentanyl in the drug supply when we were teenagers. And most people, if they use drugs, are typically in their teenage years is when they experiment. Not everyone, but that's yeah. statistically, you know, that's the case. But the difference is our young generation now has a drug that we never had. Mm-hmm. So where, you know, if you knew someone who died of a drug overdose, you're talking a very small number of people in the entire nation over yeah. a period of a year. Now I did a presentation yesterday. I was at a college and I had 100 kids in there, and I have a pre-survey that was up on the screen, and 64 students took that survey. And one of the questions is, do you know anyone who's died of a drug overdose? And over half of the kids of the respondents said, yes, they do. Crazy. When you were in high school, could you say that you knew more than
no one?
Could you even say one person that died of a drug overdose?
No.
Now we have, I mean, that's the difference. They're growing up with a drug that can kill you on first time use. It's incredible.
Yeah. And to be honest, the only thing I can think of, I personally know somebody, I don't know anyone that, I don't recall anyone I know personally who's died of a drug overdose. I know two people that are literally drunk themselves to death, and that took decades, wow. decades of effort, you know.
Wow.
And yeah. And it's one of the things I thought I was going to talk about, but it's not going to be relevant, is that there's a problem dealing with addiction in that they often are quite happy with their addiction. But with fentanyl, that's not the case, because you might not get the chance to get addicted.
Yeah, you know, I talk about addiction a lot, substance use disorder or opioid use disorder, you know, what we call addiction. And I always, at the end, I put a little asterisk next to that conversation. And the asterisk is you don't even have to become addicted to this drug. You can die the first time you use it. And there are so many instances in this country where especially our young people, you know, they're going online and they're buying what they think is an Adderall or a Xanax or Percocet. And I mean, there's even instances where they'll split them in half. They'll break that pill in half, and one child will take one half, and the other child will take the other, and one dies and one doesn't. And this could be first time drug use. And the number of parents I've spoken to where their kids are just, and I'm not making excuses, but the consequence for using drugs should not be death.
But, yeah, no, that's a way you have to tell it, isn't it?
Yeah,
because like I said, you. Like I said, I deliberately made sure that I didn't look up anything to do with fentanyl, because I'm aware of my biases. And it's just like, right. So often if I'm doing a particular topic, I might just refresh on something. And because I was talking to you about fentanyl, I was just like, right, whatever you do, don't go on the internet. Don't look up anything, because I will develop a bias which potentially would line up with my existing biases, right? So it's just like, so don't do that, because I am of a generation, you're probably the same, that if when we were kids, nobody really cared if you had a little dabble in something, because it wasn't expected to kill you. So it's just like, you should learn from your mistakes. Yeah, you know, and if you don't let them have a little bit of leash, they'll always be tugging on it until they get off. So just don't make a big deal about it. If they smoke a bit of weed, do a line of coke or something like that, just we will monitor it and see if it becomes a problem. All right. But like you said, nobody expected to die from it.
Yeah. And that's the case now. It 2 milligrams, I can't overemphasize that enough. I mean, we are talking about a couple granules of salt or sand. That's the typical lethal dose of this deadly drug, 2 milligrams. So, you know, I one of the things I do, especially when I talk to people, is I ask if you drink coffee, and then I get a sugar packet out. A typical sugar packet, at least in the United States, is a gram.
Yeah.
So a gram is 1,000 milligrams. So if 2 milligrams is a deadly dose, that one sugar packet is 500 deadly doses. 500 deadly doses. And I, in fact, I, well, so I have one here, but.
Yeah. No, no. Everybody knows what you mean. It's the same wherever you go in any country. You have these little packets of sugar that you stick in,
yeah,
which are roughly a teaspoon.
Yeah. And I, sorry to go off screen here for a minute.
No, that's all right.
But I actually, I transfer the one packet of sugar, you know, this is sweet and low, into a little vial, and I pass that around the room. And that right there is enough to kill 500 people. So when that's sprinkled crazy. Into our drug supply, our pills, you know, cocaine, methamphetamine, you know, I want them to realize that this is 500 deadly doses right
there. So reference for people who are can't see that or have never done cocaine, if you were at a party with that cocaine, that'd be enough for about five lines. What you've just displayed. That's about and they're not generous lines. You know, no one's going crazy all night long. But there's lovely. Yeah, right. So even if you did all of that yourself, all five lines throughout the night, nobody's going to expect you to die.
No.
But there, effectively, you have enough there to kill 500 people.
500 people in that tiny little bit of you know, 1 gram, which is, it's. I say the word game changer a lot, and it is. It's a game changer. I mean, we've just hit it here when we talked about it. I mean, we didn't know peers who were dying of drug overdose.
Yeah.
And now I can't go to a school or talk to a crowd and ask, hey, do you know anyone, and have no hands raise. It just every single time. I mean, I get a large number of people who will raise their hands and say, yeah, I know someone. It's that's never happened before because it's.
So I just, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt and cut you off. I do apologize. Because that's interesting because once upon a time, you would rely on adults to educate you. Whereas now it's the children with the experiences that the adults never had. So who can educate who?
Well, that's, yeah. My thing is to give them the information.
No, but you're somebody who actually knows you have to listen to children because of the information you're getting from them. But like I said, if I was, and I say this openly, like if I was having a conversation with kids, you know, like 15, 16, 14, 15, 16-year-olds and talking about fentanyl or drugs in general, there's nothing they're going to tell me that I'm going to believe because I've already done it 10 times over. But I don't know anyone that's died of a drug overdose.
Yeah.
So actually, I'm the least experienced person in the classroom. Who would argue all day long he's got more experience than all of them combined. So who's going to educate who? Because I've never lost anybody to drugs. And everyone in that classroom knows somebody that's died of a fentanyl overdose.
That's an interesting perspective, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, it's a problem of education now because the people you need to educate are the wrong ones, if you know what I mean. Because people like me are still the same people that think drugs should be legalized because we actually don't know what drugs we're talking about anymore. Because we haven't done any for 20 years, 30 years, whatever, you do know what I mean. And when we did, we smoked Bob Marley style weed. And it's just like, and none of us know of it. And if you say somebody died of a drug overdose, we're going to adamantly defend our hill. Well, they must have been really heavy, dirty heroin addicts, probably didn't eat properly, didn't, you know. Took years. No. This was a 15-year-old, well-educated child who comes from a great family, went to church every Sunday, proper members of the community that everybody would be proud of, and they just tried it once, and it was just 2 milligrams, and now they're dead.
You know, when I first started talking about building a tolerance to a drug and then, you know, building that dependence and then that addiction to a drug. And then it hit me after I got done with all that, realizing that we don't even need to go there. We don't need to build a dependence and a tolerance to the drug. One time is all it takes. Mm. So that's why I put the asterisk on it and say, hey, look, you know, this is our typical, stereotypical, you know, what a someone who uses drugs, you know, who builds that tolerance and that dependence to the drug and becomes addicted to it, and then, you know, perhaps they go homeless, or perhaps they lose all of their relationships, or perhaps they overdose, you know, and perhaps they go to jail. With fentanyl, it's a lot different because we have that person in mind. You know, like you said, if you would, you know, 20 years ago, if you think about the person who died of a drug overdose, you're thinking all those things. You know, what kind of
that's what I was thinking when I was coming to talk to you.
Fall down.
But that's exactly what I was thinking when I was coming to talk to you. So it's just like, this is going to be, and I'm going to exaggerate slightly, but I'm, again, where am I saying bias? I was a bit like, this is going to be some crazy DEA guy who spent his entire life chasing after drug dealers, and he's got a bit of a bias about how bad drugs are. Do you know what I mean? And like I said, and I really am glad I looked nothing up, because otherwise I would have, do you know what I mean? You'd have never have convinced me that this fentanyl thing could be so bad. Do what I mean.
Yeah. Again, well, I appreciate that because removing those biases and gives you a clean perspective, and it allows us to have a conversation that we can both learn from, and the listeners can learn from.
So. Yeah. Well, it surprises me because it's probably about the best thing I thought about in the last few weeks is like, do not look up anything because you'll create a bias. I don't know where that level of insight come from. That's probably my one fluke this month.
That's right.
But it is, because like I said, is, you know, I'm a 90s, it's like I was a 90s teenager in early 20s, and that in the UK, that had terrific party scene. And you can read that into whatever you want. but, you know, everybody who was around in that era would know what that meant. And it's kind of when the casual recreational drug market publicly exploded. And when I say it was more underground, it was more everyone associated the 60s, 70s, and the 80s, film stars and rock stars. By the time we got to the 90s, everybody was supposed to be doing it.
That's what we all believed, right? I mean, it's...
Yeah. That's it. And then most of us kind of like, well, this is getting in the way of actually having a job and a family and stuff like that. And I can't actually go out and party anymore because the kids are, you know, and stuff. Although I don't have kids, but, you know, it's, you eventually just kind of grow out of it. I'm still a bit kind of stuck on this. Oh, actually, when I was growing up, there wasn't a drug. It was unlikely. The chance of you taking a drug that would kill you the first time, you would have to have a huge amount in your system for that to happen, or a severe one in a million reaction.
100%. I mean, the difference between heroin and fentanyl is about 30 milligrams of heroin. It'd be, you know, really what we consider a lethal dose compared to the 2 milligrams with the fentanyl. So yeah, absolutely. It'd have to be like winning the lottery. It would just have to, it'd be that extreme case of
and then there would be attached circumstances that probably made it the most unfortunate perfect storm.
So 100%.
That must be difficult for you guys to have navigated because it's such a shift. You know, because you've got decades of how things work. And then it just probably changed overnight.
It did. And now, you know, now we can look at it. You know, we can play Monday morning quarterback and look at it and see all the problems and all the opportunities that we missed. You know, like, for instance, how we treat pain in this country. You know, and that changed in the mid-1990s. Everything changed, you know, with legal opioids. It's interesting. That's what's changed the drug landscape. You know, we have such a different drug from just 20, 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. We have a drug that now will kill you on first-time drug use. And it's something that we've never had before. So we have a young generation who's listening to us, who never had this problem, and they have friends dying from first time drug use, or casual drug use, you know, or experimental drug use. It's certainly,
how's fentanyl taken?
I'm sorry.
How's fentanyl taken?
So orally is probably the biggest way we see it, through pills, you know, you swallow a pill, you know, but, we still see a lot of injection, and we see a lot of what we call foil smoking. So they'll take either the powder or they'll take a pill and they'll crush it and they'll put them in aluminum foil and they'll burn the bottom. And then they'll take a straw and inhale those.
So just like smoke. cocaine and stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a lot of people don't know. A lot of people think injections the fastest way for a drug to get to the brain. The fastest way is actually smoking. So injections. So we do see a lot of people taking fentanyl with needles. It's still a big problem. But like I said, number one is certainly the pill. We've saturated this country with pills. And there's a pill that's counterfeit, and there's a good chance that there's a counterfeit that there's fentanyl or other some type of or other some other substance in it.
And does that make it harder to then stop the smuggling of it because it's now pill form? Is it an easier disguise?
You know, there. When I train law enforcement and talk to law enforcement, the interdiction of the drug is really no different than any other drug. I mean, the traffickers aren't. There's nothing special about fentanyl in the trafficking or smuggling of it that's unique or different than any other drug. So if it worked for heroin, it works for fentanyl. If it worked for marijuana or cocaine or any other drug, it's the same. So they already have the infrastructure. They already you know, they're very good at smuggling drugs into the United States. They're very, very good at it. So now it's just another drug to add to their catalog, you know, and it's a drug that's very, very inexpensive for them to manufacture. I mean, pennies to make these pills. And if the result of it is they can sell these in the United States for a lot more. I mean, even wholesale, I mean, buy these under a dollar and they're still making, you know, if it cost them, let's say 5 cents to make a pill and they're selling them for 50 cents to a dollar and they're selling millions and millions of these pills, you can do the math. And then you know, it's a lot of money involved.
But I mean, this is has always actually, like I said, and this I wouldn't apply this argument to fentanyl. That had always previously been one of my biggest arguments for why drugs should be legalized, because the sheer amount of money that they make from it is actually the reason it's always going to be difficult to stop it. Whereas you could, and the you know, for every million, well, every billion that they make, you're probably spending 10 billion trying to stop it. And why not just stop trying to stop it, license it all, and tax it like we do with every other pharmaceutical drug? But that's not going to work in this case, because you fall into the moonshine category now. It's happened, the gene. But that's the thing, isn't it? For pretty much every country has some form of cottage industry, is a phrase that we use in the UK, where like you can make homebrew beer, say, right? But then there's always the person that wants to make moonshine. Yeah. And no amount of law is going to stop the person that wants to make moonshine. While the other 99 people in the room are there to learn how to do homebrew beer just for him and his mates on Super Bowl day, there's going to be that one guy who's going to be like, where do I get the moonshine stuff from? You know, look, mate, that's not what we're here for. All right, what room's the moonshine in? Because there's always that one guy.
No, you're absolutely right. You know, the whole marijuana experimentation, the whole marijuana is an issue, you know, for years in this country, at least we heard, you know, the same argument. Let's tax it. Let's legalize it and tax it, and we'll make money off it. And we're doing that now in several states. And it's a disaster. We spend more money on the societal costs in places like Colorado than we make in the tax revenue. Like, we have outspent the tax revenue because of the increased hospital visits, especially to our young people.
This is where I say about the problem is the genie probably is out the bottle, because it should have been introduced in the 80s and 90s, where we were still smoking the Bob Marley spliffs and not the stuff that they've created today. Although I still think that, because they've just decriminalized it, or about to decriminalize it in Germany, where you'll be allowed to carry up to 2.5 grams, or 25 grams. And I don't know what that is in weed, because it used to be in ounces, eighths and quarters and stuff when I was a teenager. So I don't know what that looks like now. And they're even allowing you to grow your own within, I think, 3 plants or something. But I think the bit that's missing is that you've got to hone down the strength. Do you know what I mean? It's just like And the reason I say that, I'm not actually advocating it as a good substance. What I'm saying is sometimes you've got to control the flow of the war, not keep trying to win the battle. And if you want to change things culturally, sometimes it's best to get in there and reduce what the culture has taken on. If that makes sense.
It does make sense. And we've passed that.
Yeah. That I think that's the problem. Yeah. Yeah. That opportunity is gone. So go on.
No. Good.
But yeah, I just, so where is the United States now with the fentanyl and what is your program doing now?
So we now lose about 110,000 people a year in the United States to drug overdose. 110,000 people. And I didn't look up all your statistics, but you guys are maybe a tenth of that, if that. So, and I like to put that in perspective. In the United States, we've been tracking that data since 1968. From 1968 to the year 2000, we lost about 210,000 people-ish.
Yeah.
And a lot of people. I'm not trying to minimize their lives or anything.
No, but in numbers terms, it's not.
In numbers terms, it's a lot of people, but it's 32 years to reach 210,000 people. In the last 2 years alone in this country, we've lost over 210,000 people in the last 2 years alone. So that's where we are. So in this country, in the United States, we lose about 12 to 13 people every single hour because of drugs. And 75% of those on average is because of fentanyl. So we had this, if you look at the number of people dying, it's kind of a horizontal line. And then all of a sudden it just turns vertical. And the big reason it turned vertical is because of the introduction of fentanyl in our drug supply. And that's why I say it's changed the drug landscape. It's changed casual drug use. So that's where we are. We're to a point where a drug is now killing people on first time drug use, and it's changed everything. And not only that, it's gotten into our entire drug supply, where it was introduced as a cut into heroin, and then now it's in all of our pills. It's in cocaine. It's in methamphetamine. And if you look at the number of people dying from cocaine in this country, that's increased since starting around 2016. Why? Fentanyl. If you look at the number of people dying from methamphetamine, those numbers have increased. Same time period. Why? Fentanyl. I mean, fentanyl has found its way in our entire drug supply, and it's devastating. I mean, I 110 may not sound like a lot, but that's...
No, but it is because it was none before. You know what I mean?
What's that?
It is because, like you're saying, the reason it's different is because once upon a time, like you and I were saying, unless you had the most tragic circumstances to make a perfect storm, nobody died from first-time use. It was, like you said, it was like a lottery numbers is what you're talking about. That's right. So you could actually be a 20-year addict and one day wake up and say, today I'm going to be clean and actually clean up. Whereas now, you can take something thinking it's safe and it's just an appeal, and that's the last thing you ever did. And that's a significant difference.
Significant difference. Absolutely. The number of people that I've had come up to me after my presentations, especially when they're open to the public, and I have a lot of people that work in the treatment and recovery field who struggled with a substance use disorder themselves. A number of those people who've come up to me afterwards and said, I'm so glad that fentanyl wasn't in the drug supply when I was a kid. You know, I was addicted to cocaine I remember one individual said for 10 years of his life. And he goes, if fentanyl was around, I'd be dead. No doubt about it. You know, I had a lady in one of my classes who struggled with heroin from high school up into her early 20s. And she said, I don't even know how I'm here, but I'm so lucky that fentanyl wasn't around because I'd be dead. Yeah. You know, that's the change. It's we went from, you know, to reiterate what you just said, no one dying to people dying, you know, every 5 minutes in this country, someone dies. And there's a 75% chance that person died because of fentanyl.
That's crazy. It's, you know, because I mean, that it's like dropping somebody in the swim pool that can't swim, but saying you should be right to get to the side, and then dropping them in the Atlantic Ocean and saying, see how you get on.
Yeah, that's what it is. And you know, it's interesting. Also, I dive into a lot of the research and the studies and stuff. Drug use in this country has actually decreased, especially with our young people. You know, if you take out marijuana and you take out alcohol, the number of young people in this country using drugs like heroin or fentanyl or meth or coke has actually decreased. But if you look at our numbers, they've all sharply increased, especially our young people. And why? Like we said earlier, I mean, that's statistically, that's when people try drugs. It's when people experimenting with drugs. And now they just, now they have a drug that just has changed everything. I mean, first time drug use, we can't overemphasize that enough.
It's interesting as well. I mean, I don't know how true this is, but you used to hear things like, I remember as a teenager growing up, and like I said, I've never done any of the opioids, like heroin or methadone or crack or anything like that. But you used to hear sometimes on the news, people saying like, somebody's died of an overdose, the police believe it could be a particularly strong strain that wasn't cut down, et cetera, et cetera. And we're just advising all heroin users out there, please be careful where you're getting your heroin from, because we believe there's a dodgy batch out there, you do admit. And people kind of, like I said, it's that there was always this thing, you had to have done something wrong to have OD'd on your choice of recreational drug. Everybody would be like, if I heard of somebody that died in a rumor that they died of a cocaine overdose, you'd all be like, Jesus, that they must have been doing something wrong. There's no way that just happened. They must have already had a heart condition. You'd be making excuses for cocaine. You'd be making excuses for heroin, even if you'd never touched it in your life. You'd be like, oh, that's not normal. That's not what normal people have. You know. And this is the thing, because, and the other thing as well is the chances when I was growing up of you taking something not knowing it was next to zero. You know, because you weren't going to take cocaine by accident. You weren't going to inject heroin or smoke crack by accident. I know somebody could sort of drop something in your drink, but people, that wasn't as common as people thought it was, because nobody was going to waste their money like that. There was no gain to it. You know, it wasn't Rohypnol, so it didn't have a gain to it for somebody. Yeah. But this is different. Like you said, because somebody could be taking a tablet thinking it's something completely different.
And that happens quite a bit. In fact, I would argue that most of the people who died of a heroin overdose, or at least they thought they died of a heroin overdose until the autopsy and the lab reports came back and told the family that, no, it's fentanyl.
Yeah.
It's a tasteless drug. It's an odorless drug. And they're not ordering it. You know, now they are, because it's because people are going back for the fentanyl because it's such an addictive drug. But a lot of folks, especially our people that are dying with, you know, more of the casual or the experimentation drug user, they're looking for the Percocet. They're looking for the Adderall. They're looking for the Oxy. They're looking for their Xanax bars. You know, they're looking for cocaine. They're looking for methamphetamine, or they're looking for heroin, whatever the drug is. And they're getting fentanyl in it, and they have zero clue. Zero clue. They're not asking for fentanyl, but it's littered itself in our entire drug supply.
And that's probably just because it's cheaper to produce.
Absolutely cheaper to produce.
This so like, is who cares? Drug that, who cares what they're asking for? We'll just give them the cheapest product we have available.
And it's not only is it cheap, it's also addictive.
Yeah.
So not only if I were a drug trafficker am I going to make more money, but I'm also going to make more money because I'm going to create regular customers. And ultimately, that's what I want. I want people to come back to me. There are places in the United States where you can get free samples of fentanyl with a business card with a telephone number on it, because they're banking on you coming back as a regular customer. So if I'm a drug trafficker, I want to put a little bit of something very addictive into the drug. So I don't want to kill you. But if I'm selling to a lot of folks, I'm okay with a couple people dying as long as I get more people coming back as regular customers.
Yeah.
You know, this is what a drug trafficker's thinking. So yeah, I'm making more money, and not only because it's cheaper to make, but because of the return, you know, that's where the money.
I think that's something that a lot of people misunderstand, is these cartels are very, very money driven. And they are also, and I say that actually as a compliment in a sense, some of them have some of the best business mindsets you'll ever meet You know, people like to think, you can think what you want about them, but don't believe all of the culture. They might be ruthless and they might kill you as soon as look at you. But these guys are very astute and they understand business better than anyone you'll meet in Harvard.
100%. Yep.
And people don't realize, like, no, these guys run empires and they know exactly how to do it from the ground right to the top. And they can walk into a room and outsmart a politician, and they can walk down the street and outsmart a pickpocket.
Not only that, not only do they have, many of them have the intelligence, they also have the luxury of not having to follow the law or the rules or ethics or morals. So their thinking can go beyond that box that we're all in, you know, the box we all have to be all in, you know, using our ethics, using our morals, but they can go beyond that. So if they can figure out a way to make more money faster and use their intellect to do it, then they're absolutely, you hit the nail on the head. They're people, we look at them as just ruthless, and they are, they're very ruthless. They're very dangerous, very violent folks. But I tell people when I talk about the cartels and transnational criminal organizations, don't underestimate that these people are very good at what they do. Mm. This isn't just, you know, hey, we think we're going to do this and we'll roll the dice and see if it works. This is very calculated. This is a business. You know, these people can run circles around, you know, Bill Gates and Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos. I mean, they at least they think they can, and they're making quite a bit of money. So.
And they run international operations.
Yes.
And some of these people make more money than companies listed on the stock exchange.
Mm-hmm. They do. And so, the two big ones for fentanyl, the Sinaloa cartel and the CJNG are very, very, very violent and very, I hate to use the word successful, but as far as making money, they are successful. Yeah.
But this is what I think, like, people don't understand is, and I think it's a really important message that people do have to understand is, these guys are smart. You have sat in a room with them. They're probably the smartest guy in any room you've ever been in. And I don't care if you graduated from MIT or Oxford University. They might not have your academic knowledge. They run a company that is international and can outcompete companies listed on the stock exchange.
Yeah, they do.
So they're not dumb.
No, not at all. And they're difficult to work from a law enforcement perspective, from especially from a federal law enforcement perspective. They're very difficult to work. The way their structures, they're more of a horizontal organizational structure, and they have decision making, very important decision making throughout the organization. They're not asking for permission. They're not looking at a personnel manual or HR department.
No,
there's nothing like that at all. It's you know, things are implied. There's, you know, they're going to do it. And the consequences are typically very brutal, very violent. You know, if you don't do it, you're going to be eliminated and someone else is going to take your position and do it.
Yeah. I was talking to somebody a couple of weeks ago on here, on my podcast, and his dad was a member of the Chicago mob. And I spoke to him twice in the end, because it was just like trying to navigate how his dad stayed alive. Because his dad died of old age, one of the few people that did. And people, again, don't understand this, and it's something that still troubles me to this day. You could be side by side with somebody that grew up on your street. You were played together, kids together, joined the firm or the cartel together, rise through the ranks together. But if the boss says, kill him, they don't hesitate. Even if he is your best friend, godfather to your kids and best man at your wedding. If the guy above you says, kill him, it's done.
It's done.
Because you know he might get the same order and we'll do it to you.
Yeah. It's what a way to live, huh? I mean,
they love it. Some of them love it.
Yeah. I've talked to some folks who they do. But it's, I don't know. I think that's a high stress, always looking over your shoulder.
But I think it's like you said, that order something you said earlier is people don't recognize, they don't think like us. They don't think about the laws like we do. They don't think about principles like we do. They don't have the same moral structure as we do. So when people, you know, like when I say I don't understand, that's not really nuanced and detailed enough. I'm literally in a different galaxy.
Yeah, I think we all are. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what money does to that. A lot of these folks, it puts them in this, you know, they think they're putting food on the table for their families by living this life. And it's hard for us to understand because it's like you said, there is no principle. There is no morals. There's no, I mean, they're savages when you look at it, from that perspective. I mean, they're horrible human beings who prey on others for their own financial gain.
Yeah.
You know?
And that's it. And within their own structures, they're ruthlessly ambitious, and they're looking and trying to emulate the people above them.
No, we certainly don't underestimate them. They're not only the danger and the violence that they bring, but just the intelligence that in certain levels of these cartels are. It's incredible. I mean, this is big money. And this is why, and then we have such a demand for drugs, especially in the United States, that you know they're willing to fill that, you know, to be the supply.
So we keep trying to talk about the program, and we keep getting mentioned. I'm loving this conversation. I'm just conscious of your own time as well. So explain to people what you started up when you retired.
So, you know, originally I created a program for law enforcement, specifically for law enforcement. It was just the dangers of illicit fentanyl, you know, what this drug is. And a lot of it really, and kind of giving you the whole history here, is it started around that there's this belief, and there's a lot of folks still in the United States that believe this, that just being around fentanyl is going to kill you, that you can be exposed to this drug. And that the reality is that's not true. So when I developed this program, that was one of the things that we were pushing, is that, hey, look, you know, you can handle this drug as a police officer or a first responder. You know, you can put it in your evidence room and not everyone's going to die, and you can be around it. And then from there, it really just exploded. It started out as a 2-hour presentation, and then it went to a 3-hour, and now it's a 4-hour. I've done it 55 times in the United States, 14 different states. And again, it originally started for law enforcement and other first responders. And then we started bringing teachers in, school administrators in, hospital workers in, a lot of folks from the treatment, recovery, social workers. I invite parents, but that's my, that's the hardest audience to get is parents. A lot of them just have their head in the sand or they don't want to hear it because, you know, out of sight, out of mind. But a lot of times these are open to everyone, you know, to the public, but, first responders is probably my primary audience.
Yeah.
I get asked to talk to kids a lot. So I did a lot of small scale stuff. And then I just developed a 1-hour presentation that just talks about just the dangers of the drug. You know, my 4-hour is very comprehensive. I talk about, you know, substance use disorder, addiction. I talk about the cartels, you know. When I was with DEA, I spent 7 years in South Texas, so I know a lot about the cartels from the work that we did down there. Talk about the dark web. I talk about, talk about a little of everything. I mean, it's a pretty comprehensive program. So the 1 hour is more just for the student level. It's just how do we give them the information, let them know that, you know, how little of this drug it takes to kill you. Why their friends are dying on first time drug use or casual drug use, you know, because it's such a small drug that it's found its way into everything. I just did my first 1-hour presentation actually yesterday. I had 100 students at Missouri State University in Springfield, Missouri. I've had interest from other schools, so that's something that I'm going to slowly start ramping up. But I started a nonprofit organization. It's called Only 2MG Incorporated, and entire board of directors is retired DEA agents, and our goal is to educate people, especially with illicit fentanyl. I hope to make an impact that way. I want people to know that this is a deadly drug, and I'm tired of knowing and meeting parents who are losing their young ones to this deadly drug. And if I can get a person, especially a young person, to think twice and at least empower them with information to make an informed decision that could save their life or maybe save the life of a peer, then that's a plus for me.
Well, if it were possible, and it could be possible, you know, the more the movement grows, the more you can get something out of there. Is there a policy that could be changed in law, or just, do you know what I mean? I know that's like, well, how big's a basket sort of thing, but is there positive steps that could be made in policy that could help or make a difference?
I think there's a combination of things. The problem is a lot of this is feel good stuff. It's what I call the good idea genie. You know, like there's been this big push in the United States for drug test strips. Well, I can tell you why I don't like, this is just one example, but I can tell you why I don't like them. Now, because they give people a false sense of security. You know, you can if you use if you you go online and you buy, let's say, two pills, you're going to take one tonight. We buy three pills. You're going to take one, I'm going to take one, and we're going to test one. Make sure it's clean. So in order to test a pill, you have to destroy the entire pill. So we've destroyed one pill. So we have two left. That doesn't mean there's not fentanyl on the other two pills. It only takes 2 milligrams of this stuff to kill you. So we have this false sense of security because we tested a pill. So we have a lot of policymakers who are like, that's what we need. We need more test strips. That'll help people. That'll let them know whether or not there's fentanyl in the drug. It only lets them know what's in that one drug. It doesn't let them know what's in the next drug. Or in that batch. So is it wrong to think that way or to throw these good ideas out? Certainly not, but we look at it too simplistic, like this is going to be the solution. There's got to be a combination of things we do. I mean, and not only policy, we got to change our views on this stuff. Like we stigmatize people that use drugs. And we do it and we call them addicts, we call them junkies, we call them losers and we and then we And then we can't be empathetic to when they do die. Oh, he made that bed, he has to sleep in it. This is a human life we're talking about. You know, and it's not only we have this cultural belief that these people are somehow worse than us, but then you look at all the things we do in our society that contributes to that belief. And what I mean by that is we don't properly fund these treatment centers. We don't make treatment more accessible to these folks to get help. Because in our mind, they've done something criminal, they've done something immoral, they've done something wrong. So screw them, let them take care of themselves. But they're dying. These are human beings. We need to change our approach. And when we start to do that, then maybe there's some policy, maybe there's some shift that we can start doing to address this. I'm not a big, you know, you mentioned decriminalize. I don't think that's the answer right now. I think we've, like you said, I think we've gone too far. Now you said that yourself. You know,
Oh,
this
no, I agree. I agree. I mean,
we've gone too far down the road.
So a couple of years ago, I mentioned my friend who died of alcoholism. I didn't mention it was me that ID'd his body, and he was found by his best friend at school. I was his housemate. We lived in London together, smoked a ton load of weed, bought Xanax and all of that stuff, right? What I never really understood is when I just kind of woke up one day and it's just like, and I don't have a reason that I can give you. I never touched another joint. I never smoked another weed. I never took another tab. I never did anything again. I can't tell you why. I just woke up one day in my 20s and was just like, I've got to go to work. You know what I mean? You know, and just went to my job like I always did. But and I've oversimplified that process, but that was just something in front inside of me, right? What I didn't
A lot of
know,
folks are like that, though.
that's my general experience. Now, his sister was a crack addict and is still alive today. And the last time I heard from the surviving brother, they have found her, but she's barely able to even communicate who she is, right? But that's a lifelong abuse. And I know from my experience with her and with her brother, when he'd been in and out of programs. We did everything we could. She was happy being an addict, and there was nothing you were going to do about that. And my friend, and I'll say his name because it's actually him there. That's why there's a montage of pictures of him. It's when I lived with him, and it's in memory of him as I remember him at his best. So And funnily enough, he has a Sonic head tattoo on his arm, and I have one on the other arm. We had them done at the same time when we were eight, when I was 18. Right. So, do you know what I mean? This, it's not some random guy. It's a guy that,
sure,
you know, was one of the closest I've ever been to, and I miss him dearly and love him to bits. And but when we had to go, me and his best friend Rupert had to go to his house after the police had removed the body, and we found all of these empty alcohol bottles. And every conversation I'd ever had with him in the last few years, he was like, yeah, no, I'm sober these days. You know, I'm not touching anything. I'm not, but he was still an alcoholic. And when the autopsy come through, he had enough alcohol and pharmaceutical stuff inside of him to put out an elephant. And I'm a guy that's done everything alongside him, had stopped. But when I saw him, he was stone cold sober. When his, you know, when Rupert, his best mate from school, saw him, he'd stone cold sober. But the conversations I used to have with him sometimes, and it comes from a place of where we've both been in dark places together and kind of had to figure a way out. He said, when I'm sober, there's a part of me that's deeply unhappy. He said, but when I get wrecked, I'm at peace. He says, now, I know it's not to everyone else, it's not healthy. He said, I'm not happy. I just feel at peace with myself whenever I'm drunk, whenever I'm this, whenever. And so it made me understand that addiction isn't what non-addicts think it is.
Yes, it there's so many demons, you know.
Mm.
There's a lot of reasons why we use drugs or alcohol. And sometimes it's just social pressures or boredom. Yeah. But there are a lot of people that are dealing with true demons, you know, trauma, you know, maybe mental abuse, emotional abuse, sexual abuse, just some type of trauma in their lives. And this is their coping mechanism.
Yeah. You know, I remember him telling me once he used to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was Rupert's dad that took him there. Right. Cause that's, you know, and Nick was in his 20s. And I said to him, oh, so, you know, why did you stop? He said, I was listening to all these people, and I just realized that they had all these serious problems. He said, I just loved getting drunk. So, but as he got older and older and older, he was just like, it's the only time I feel at peace. He said, when I'm sober and I have to deal with the rest of the world, I don't like it. I don't like the people. I don't like the world. But when I drink, and what I'm trying to kind of probably in a clumsy way articulate to people is that thing that you were saying, we have this idea of what an addict is, what a junkie is, and we sort of derail them into these derogative terms to categorize them alongside vermin, cockroaches, rats, scum, and actually what you don't see is a deep, probably a very deep thinking, meaningful, complex personality who finds peace in a different place to where you and I might find it. And some of the coping mechanisms that maybe you and I have developed, whatever, or strategies, and people could say, oh, it's the delusion and it's the matrix or do it, or whatever it is. But there are some very significant people who get lost in the system because the only way they can find peace is by becoming addicted to something. And it's, they're not really trying to do anything other than just, I'm okay now.
Yeah, I've experienced that with myself, with people I've interviewed, and just throughout my 3-decade career in law enforcement, a lot of folks who will say the same thing, that the substance gives them a peace that nothing else can. No, I totally concur. I remember I talked to an individual not too long ago who struggled with heroin, went to prison. But talk about every day in his life, you know, it's, he'd wake up in the morning and all he could think about was getting high that evening. And he lost all his relationships. His family kicked him out because he's stolen everything and took it to pawn shops, and he lost his job, lost his home. He was living on the streets, and even OD'd a couple times. And was revived by naloxone, and went to prison a couple times. And all he could think about every single morning was when he got up was getting high that night. It's all he could think about. And he would do whatever he had to do. He'd steal, he'd beg, borrow, whatever he could do for a couple dollars to get high. And that was his life. And And that's how he coped with his demons in life. We have to address that. The whole mental health and that's the one piece that we're missing here. So, I think back to your question on policy, I mean, we start tackling trauma and mental health differently in this world, we're going to resolve a lot of things. We're going to resolve a lot of people's drinking and the drugs, and I'm not saying we're going to eliminate it. I'm not naive, but we're certainly going to. It's the root of the problem, right? That's what we have to go after. It's not just the it's not just the problem of the day. It's why are they using it? And like you said, I mean, you have two different people, one who struggles with addiction and one who it's just a Friday night thing. And that happens, and I talk about that with drugs quite a bit, is there are folks who can use drugs and casually use them and they're fine. But there are people who get trapped and they feel like they need this drug, like you said, to feel normal or to feel at peace with themselves, or just to avoid the dope sickness.
Because one of the things I noticed, and I've been around a few addicts over the years now, so I do some coaching and I'm a qualified hypnotherapist and stuff like that, and is what we think is painful, like well, you've lost your family, you've lost your house, you've lost your job. That's not what's painful for them.
Nope, not at all.
So that we are already in the wrong place when we, you know what I mean? It's just like, because we've created this scenario and this we've painted the picture of what pain looks like to them, and you're like, no, that's not painful to them. Sorry, losing that isn't painful to them. Having that was painful, and that's what they couldn't cope with. And it just caused them pain. Your love, your that job, that security, the home, the wife, the husband, whatever, the kids. No, that hurt them. That hurt them deeply, and that's what they couldn't have. So when that disappeared because they were somewhere else, they would find. And it's not the same for every addict. So, just to make sure we're clear on that, but. That they could find a peace that when they come out of that state and faced everything that the rest of us might be eternally grateful for, it brought pain back to them, a pain they can't cope with.
And we hear that quite a bit, and that's one of the reasons why I occasionally I'll have someone that says, "Oh, you sound kind of like you're hugging trees." But then I can't tell you how many senior police officers I've had come up to me or call me or text me later on and say, "You know, it's really good and refreshing to hear someone with 30 years of experience who I don't want to cuss, but who cares? Who gives a, you know
No,
what,
you can cuss.
you
It's
know?"
an adult podcast. You can chuck out as many fucks as you want. It's
Someone who
fine.
gives a shit. I mean, someone who to have a and I tell people now, especially have a little empathy. I'm not saying that there shouldn't be consequences for the things that we do in life. I'm not saying that
It's
we
different
shouldn't
conversations, isn't it? It's.
it is a different conversation. I mean, having empathy goes a long way. I mean, using naloxone, Narcan, saving a person's life. I remember an individual, a young officer who got an award from his department, and he was like, "What did I really do? I just saved some addict's life. What did I really do?" And I was talking to his family member of his, who I knew, because the officer was struggling with this. He's like, "Do I really deserve this award?" I'm like, "You saved a human life. I mean, have some empathy. I know that it's that you're seeing it from someone who might go back into that life. But look at you're giving that person a chance. Maybe he doesn't. Maybe that person finds a way to turn that off and get treatment and get help and live a more positive life. But
Look,
it's
so
difficult.
here's the thing. So many, many years ago, and this was partially cocaine related. I ended up getting into trouble with the law for stealing money from a company I used to work for, right? Because he was selling cocaine and didn't pay me my money, but it was a legitimate business, right? So this is all public record if in the UK. Do you know what I mean? I went to court, I ended up with community service, had to pay back £5,000, all that eventually led to me losing all of my bank accounts and going bankrupt, right? And so I'm 30 years old and I'm sat, because you can imagine I'm like, oh, living at home with my mum and I'm bankrupt. I literally have zero choices. I'm clean as a whistle, haven't done drugs for years. And I've sat in a creative writing class next to a lady called Janet McLean, who was an occupational therapist and specialized in head injuries. And after a few weeks of talking to me, she said, have you ever thought about working with young male adults with head injuries? I said, I can't do that because I've got a criminal record. And she was like, everybody deserves a second chance. I've been doing it for 18 years now, and I specialize in head injury rehabilitation.
Awesome. Yeah, that's right? Great.
So when I say it like that, and if I was talking about, I'd say that's an incredible human being, and that's absolutely amazing. Because I look in the mirror, and it's like, well, that's just who you are. Do you know what I mean? And I'm not able to project that on. But like you said, it was somebody's second chance on me that gave me a massive direction in my life. And I've helped several addicts, head injury, all young male adults and older male adults. I've had an incredible positive impact on people's lives as a result of somebody else's empathy, who just simply was just like, what she actually said is, because at the time I'd been doing tree surgery with my brother and had my head shaved, is, you look like a thug and I think this particular client will be scared of you. She said, but when you smile, you light up the room. But but she was able to see like this rough cut of a guy and thought, actually, having spoken to you for a few weeks, I think you actually perfect. And
it's beautiful. Yeah.
But it's exactly what you were saying. It's somebody's generosity, somebody's empathy. Mm-hmm. Was an opportunity for me that then had a positive impact. And if she hadn't given me that opportunity, I wouldn't be talking to you. And I wouldn't be learning. And we wouldn't be telling people, actually, that there's a danger in this world. And that, and you know, I don't want to be too sort of cliched or too, like you said, tree hugging. But you have set up, along with other retired DEA officers, a not-for-profit organization to educate people so their children don't get killed.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I feel like life doesn't have to be hard. I feel like, we can all be decent human beings and we can show a little empathy and it doesn't mean that there doesn't need to be consequences for the things we do in life. And it doesn't mean that
there's consequences. I did enough community service. But it's like you're saying,
empathy is beautiful, right? I mean,
it's the difference between my punishment and somebody treating me like a human being. They came side by side. I did both. I was punished and served my punishment. All right. And somebody else was empathetic towards me and gave me an opportunity.
Yeah.
And it's two different things. Yes, there is punishment that has to come into place. There is a law that has to be enforced. But this is a human being. And there are countless times in history where it has been shown time and time again, when you never gave up on somebody, sometimes they give you hope. And that's all we're asking for the opportunity to do.
It's why I do what I do. I mean, if I impacted one person yesterday, then I've impacted one person. That's one more person than that perhaps won't die, perhaps won't make, bad choices in life. That's incredible. And I wish more people would do things like that, right? I mean, now this might sound a little, dreamy, but wouldn't the world be a better place if we all had that?
But it was only just listening to you then, when you were saying about that officer, well, he was only this, he was only that. Well, that's how lots of people looked at me. But somebody was a little dreamy. And then it was another manager after that person that, because I'd done someone else being a little bit dreamy with me, was a little bit dreamy again. And I got another opportunity to do more. And, now I run my own care team. So it's, that's awesome. I've done some significant work with head injury rehabilitation. And it led to me becoming a qualified hypnotherapist and stuff like that. So I help people in other ways. But it was only because of some of that, other people's empathy from my own mistakes. I did everything to myself. And like I said, and things like that is what led me to having my own podcast. It's what led me to talking to you today. Yeah.
That's why we met.
Yeah. Yeah. And, people, I think, like you say, is people can, if they've never directly been involved, if they've never personally lost somebody, it's very easy to label something in a specific way that makes you feel comfortable deriding it and being derogatory about it. And
we find a hill to set up camp on, and then we're going to defend it by any means. And if that means, labeling other folks or belittling other folks or not wanting to help other folks, then so be it. And that's just the wrong attitude. But no, I talk about empathy. I think it's important. I think, and that's why I try to understand what drugs do to a lot of people. Like we said, there are people that can use them. They're fine. But there are people who one time they're done. I mean, their life is forever changed. And to care about those people and give them a chance. And again, not to beat this horse to death, but there doesn't mean to be consequences, things like that. But it just goes a long way. I absolutely agree. It's why it's important to me to talk about that early on. And like I said, with fentanyl, that's why I say I put the asterisk there, because I want to let them know that fentanyl is beyond all that. Sometimes that's first time, it's amazing. I think that's where we need to, as a cultural, as a society, to focus on. I don't know that policy alone can do it. I think once our focus is on caring about people, then we can figure out, all right, how do we implement laws or policy that can encourage that or strengthen that or reinforce that. But I don't know that policy alone is gonna get us there.
So let me try and ask it a different way. So, like you say, I think one of the problems is that there is an attitude that we all have, and we can all certainly dig into that. Well, why should I care if they're not going to be punished? So we have to set aside that to address people's fears. What I always find in life is that there's what's the outcome you're trying to achieve and how do you want it to be received? Because it's often, well, I want to achieve this, but it's going to be received the wrong way. So how do we want it to be received? So the outcome we want to achieve is empathy for people, but we need it to be received that there is going to be punishment for people that break the law. But whilst that punishment happens, or after the process of accountability, we need a process or a policy that enables funding so that there is an empathetic way to enable these people to perhaps take a chance on themselves. Because ultimately, that's what I had to do. I had to take a chance on myself.
Yeah.
And it's how do we do that so that everybody moves forward? So we want to achieve a certain outcome that we have potentially have an addict or somebody that may or may not take fentanyl, and we want them to be clean or to steer away from it. But we have a group of people who are rightfully fearful. So how do we achieve an outcome, and how are they going to receive it so that they like, yeah, I understand what you're saying. So it's how do you make a policy that punishes a certain group, but at the same time supports a certain group?
Oh, that, I think I'd be a billionaire if I could figure that one out, right?
Now's your opportunity to pitch that business plan.
Oh gosh. That's tough. I mean, that's the juggle, right? That's the struggle, right? I mean, we are juggling that. I mean,
But maybe that's actually the conversation, isn't it? It is, because actually, do you know what? It is a difficult answer, and because it's a difficult, and maybe the difficult answer is because we don't know what the right question is.
Yeah, maybe we just need a different question or a different perspective on the problem.
Because do you often find it's like, sorry, go on.
No, please. Yeah.
I was going to say, do you often find that you come across a parent or say a member of law enforcement who had one attitude until it affected their child, and then it was a completely different attitude?
No, you mean like a little bit of hypocrisy, maybe? You mean
I suppose it could be labeled as hypocrisy, but I was just meaning more in the sense that people have a certain belief because it's never impacted them personally. And then when it happens to somebody they really love.
Oh my goodness. Yes.
They're like, oh no, hold up. My son, my daughter, that's not who they are. My brother wasn't like that. That's not who my sister was. That's not how she was raised. That's, this happened to her, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, that happens a lot. I've actually, a lot of folks who start up organizations like mine have lost sons or daughters to drug use. And I'm not, I think it's wonderful that what they're doing, I mean, I had one that told me, like, she said, I didn't care about this stuff until it happened to my own family.
Yeah.
She was the last thing I ever, I rolled my eyes when I saw this stuff in the news or heard about this stuff. And then it happened in my own house. And now she has a nonprofit organization that does drug awareness. And
so I suppose that's the question, isn't it? Is how do you help people, or what's the question that you have to ask somebody so that they understand it could happen to their family? Because then
With fentanyl, it's a lot different because just the fact that only 2 milligrams is enough to kill you and first time drug use. So that's one thing. But as far as just that normal drug addiction that we're all kind of, accustomed to, I think we have to go back to the root cause. Are kids being raised healthy, and are there other issues in life? Are there societal challenges? Is there social pressures? I mean, is there abuse? Is there? I mean, there's so many. I don't know if I'm going down the wrong hole or not.
No, I don't. Like you said, if there was a simple answer, you'd be a billionaire.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's not a simple answer. I mean, everyone's a little different, but we definitely need a different perspective, different people to have input in here, and maybe we can together come up with some solutions here, right? Or at least get us on that path to a better solution. I've talked to a lot of families who lost folks and police officers. I know a few police officers now who have lost family members to fentanyl poisoning. It's devastating. But as far as their prior behavior, actually I didn't know any of them until they lost their sons or daughters. And it just impacted them in a way that I can't even begin to imagine. So now they're on this mission to prevent that pain in other families.
Just lastly, just to finish up, what would be your last message, question, or whatever to anyone listening?
Two things. Back to fentanyl. Understand that this is a deadly drug that can kill people, first time drug use. And then the second thing is kind of what we were talking about with empathy. You know, give a shit about people. You know, care about people. You know, try to make a difference in your community. And you don't have to start an organization to do that. You know, just small steps make a huge impact in this world. And do what you can to take a small step forward and help people.
And there you have it. Ryan and I talking about fentanyl, empathy, and ultimately human beings. Thank you very much for tuning in. Thank you very much for listening, watching. And as always, wherever you are from, whatever your beliefs, please take care and be blessed. Thank you.